technicalities. But so my talk will be about GFTs and what is the status of renormalization in these theories. So as a reminder, I recall the classification Razvan gave a few days ago. So I will talk mainly about tensorial group field theories. And they are tensorial in the sense that they use the combinatorial tools that have been developed in the tensor track approach, the so-called. So these are the two T's. Then there are field theories in the sense that we break the tensorial invariance with a non-trivial kinetic term, so hence the HEF. And finally, we want to make use at the end of the day of the group structure that presents in group field theories to implement geometric data and constraints from loop quantum gravity and spin foams. So there are several models on the market nowadays. So it all started in 2011 with the pioneering work of Joseph and Vincent. So these were TFTs in the sense of the classification below above. And now we know how to make TGFTs and more and particularly TGFTs with the gauge invariance condition, which implement the closure constraint of spin foams. So at this stage, we can essentially investigate 3D quantum gravity, and that's what I want to talk about today. So I will focus on this line, which is a model which was proven to be renormalizable last year, and I will present this to you in a Wilsonian perspective. So not really, I won't prove theorems or whatever, but just here are some motivations. So the first motivation is, of course, that GFTs are quantum field theories, so we want at least to make them perturbatively well-defined, so hence we want to renormalize them. But the more important aspect is probably to develop tools that allow ourselves to understand the dynamics in an effective way. And in particular, if we want to explore the continuum limit, we don't really care about the dynamics of a very huge chunks of our pet space-time theories. What we want is to understand the dynamics of small such pieces. So this is the first step, and something I won't touch upon in this talk is that later on we need to plug boundary data, which is very which contains many such small chunks. So, and this was a topic of Bianca's talk and also Mercedes. Okay, and why do I want to explore the Wilsonian perspective with the RG flow equations? Is because it could be a nice idea to look at a new fixed point and not only the Gaussian one. And this could be related to the kind of condensed phases that Daniele and other people are exploring, or the kind of non-perturbative resummation that Razvan was presenting the other day. Okay, so here's the outline. I'll try to be fast on this one. I will try to introduce for you the model. Then we'll define general flow equations, and I will then focus on the Gaussian fixed point and to see what are the properties of this fixed point. And finally, I will end with a very speculative, speculative part, where I will contemplate the idea of defining TGFTs in group dimension 4 minus epsilon. Okay, so let's start with this one. So if you remember what Razvan talked about last time, so a key ingredient of all these theories is the combinatorial tool of colored graphs. So what are colored graphs? They are graphs with two types of nodes, black or white, and D types of edges, depending on the dimension D. And the rule is that the edges are colored, and any such edge should link two nodes with different types, and that each node should meet exactly one edge of the same color. Okay. And what are they useful for? So essentially, they represent triangulations in a very efficient way. So here's an example. For example, in with three color graphs, you can represent triangles. So here's an elementary node and a dual triangle, and the same with reversed orientation. In 3D, which is the case we want to study today, you have four color graphs and they represent tetrahedra. So these are the elementary building blocks. And then you can glue these nodes, so connect them by edges. And what it means is simply to glue the dual simplices. So here, triangles, and here, tetrahedra. So that's it. D plus one color graphs represents triangulation in dimension D. So today we'll use four color graphs to represent the spaces of dimension three. So now, what is the usual strategy that people use in discrete approaches to 3D quantum gravity? So in spin foams, we use the fact that Euclidean gravity in 3D is essentially a BF theory. And to make sense of the otherwise ill-defined partition function, which essentially, given a manifold, measures the set of flat SU2 connection on this manifold, we discretize it on most of the time on a simplicial complex. And the key element is instead of a connection, you have holonomies associated to dual links to the triangulations, and you impose that the holonomies around closed dual path is trivial. Okay. So what I don't want to enter the details, but what I want to emphasize is that usually the combinatorial structure which is used in spin foams, for example, is a simplicial complex. But a priori, there is no reason to use a simplicial complex. So you could use any cellular complex with the right topological properties. So here, what I will use is a kind of a colored cellular complex, and I will explain what it means in the next slide. And the main advantage is that because it relies on the colored graphs, you have a notion of homology. You really understand what are all the simplices, not only the higher dimensional ones. And because you know you really encode properly how they glue together, you can control the topology better than in the usual setting, and you have, of course, the 1 over n expansion tools at your disposal. So what will be the elementary building blocks in this colored cellular complex? So they will be the three bubbles, which are three colored graphs. And these, they represent two-dimensional triangulations because of what I said before. And we'll view them as elementary chunks of three-dimensional space with the triangulated boundary represented by this. Okay, is it clear?
You take a non-planar or non-planar?
So I will take the general case, but then we'll see that the non-planar ones, they are washed away by the renormalization procedure. So but in principle, this idea works only for planar, because otherwise you have, but the non-planar ones will represent topological singularities, but you can put them in the beginning and you see that they don't flow, so you can put them to zero in this setting. Okay, I will come back to this. And now these elementary chunks, you can glue them together along triangles, which I recall are represented by these nodes. Now, how do you represent that? You just introduce a new kind of line, which is of color zero, and which we represent as dashed. So why is that? So the two different notations is really to emphasize that the geometric variables will be on these links. These links represent only the structure of the building blocks. They are purely combinatorial. So the holonomies that I was talking about for the partition function before will be associated to these lines here. And then the faces around which we will impose flatness, how do you see them on the graph? So you just consider connected sets of alternating color zero, so these, the dashed ones, and any other color L. So for example, here you have these two color zero lines, and you see that they form a closed path of color 0 and color 2 lines. And same for color 0 and 3 lines. So this means that you have two faces here running through these two lines. Okay, this is a closed face. And you can also here represent some cellular complex with boundaries. So you can also have faces running through the in between two boundaries, two boundary triangles. But it's not very important here. Okay, so once you have this kind of models, so basically it's same as Ponzano-Rege, but defined on a different kind of cellular decomposition of manifolds. So you still need to recover.
Can you explain which type of graph you have to
restrict to the producer? What, in this? To get what?
What would you do to get just
you cannot.
This language cannot accommodate
you. So you cannot get the CJ, but you, what you get is really something that measures flat discrete connections. That's in this sense that I was saying it's 3D. Okay.
So there's no way to generate only triangulation using this.
No. Because the tetrahedron is not part of this. Is not a bubble like this. But what I mean, I don't know if it's, I don't know, I don't want to say that it's as good as Ponzano-Rege or better or whatever, but it's just that if you take the perspective of discretizing the path integral, then, yeah, then you can do that, at least. Okay. And so to reach the kind of continuum limit, you need to either refine or sum, and in GFT, we adopt the second strategy and we try to sum using the QFT formalism. So let me tell you how you do that. So you introduce one dynamical variable, which is a rank 3 complex field. So a field defined on 3 copies of SU2 and going into the complex numbers. Then the partition function is defined through two main ingredients. The first one is the interaction action, S, and the second one is a Gaussian measure with a given covariance, C. So if you want to get, as elementary building blocks, the bubbles I was presenting before, what you need to put in this action here is exactly all the possible connected tensor invariants. So these are these beasts here. I will explain what they are later. And the main point I want to make here is that these will play the role of locality in our field theory. So there will be what play the role of the usual local interactions in space-time field theories for the purpose of renormalization. Okay, then the second gradient, the covariance, if you want to recover the amplitudes imposing flatness around dual faces, what you need to choose is a projector like this, which introduces the holonomy variables through this integral and imposes flatness through a bunch of delta functions. So identifying points up to some common group element. Okay. So I told you that the key thing are the tensor invariants. So let me recall what they are. So from a given drawing, connected a bubble, sorry, you can infer the invariant in the following way: to which white node you associate a field, to which black node you associate a conjugate field, and then the pattern of contractions of the lines represent identifications of group elements in the same positions in the field. Okay, so the problem, if you do that, you have a partition function which generates triangulation, cellular decompositions like this, but the amplitudes are generically divergent because simply because you impose too many constraints, and some of them are redundant. So one way of curing this is to look for put a cutoff and look for appropriate scalings. So these are the 1/n expansions. Or you can try to mimic, to do this, the same, but realize these kind of scalings in a dynamical way, thanks to a non-trivial propagator. So, but that's the point. We need to introduce, there is no notion of scale in the propagator we have so far because it's a projector. So we need to twist it a bit with the, for example, non-trivial differential operator. And what I will use in this talk is the simple choice of the Laplacian on the group acting on each of the arguments of the field. So it's essentially, I would say here we have some freedom. It's essentially a conservative choice, but it's also suggested by the some computations of Joseph and Valentin. So all in all, if you do that, you compose this with the projector I was talking before. Instead, what you get is this covariance, which has a similar structure, but instead of delta functions here, you have heat kernels on the group with a given parameter alpha. And this parameter, you integrate from zero to infinity with the weight, given by the mass term. Is it clear? So, okay. And the key point here is that all the divergences come from the region alpha close to zero, just like it's a Schwinger parameter here. And so we can use this alpha as a scale, which allows to put a cutoff and move this cutoff along the direction zero to infinity. Okay, so let me go through the core of the talk. So once you have this parameter alpha, as I said, you can use it to determine scales and to introduce scales, and I will do it in a discrete fashion. So I introduce any parameter m fixed bigger than one, and then I slice the integral over alpha. So instead of the covariance is decomposed as a sum over covariances ci, where ci is the, so to speak, the covariance in the slice I, and the slice I is given by this boundaries, okay, and it's done in a geometric way. Okay, if you do that, so the I can be viewed as some cutoff, and you can define an effective action at this cutoff scale I with coupling constants which depend on I here. Okay, so this is the same action we had before. I put some rescalings here, but it's not important. And then you can define a discrete flow of coupling constants by just performing the path integral in the slice I, taking the logarithm, and up to some wave function renormalization, you get a new definition, a new effective action at a lower scale, I minus one. And so this defines a flow of coupling constants here. And the couplings, I remind you, are labeled by the bubbles, the elementary building blocks. Okay. So the way to organize this, to define this flow, relies a lot on the power counting argument. So we can prove the nice point of this kind of finite size slicing of the scales is that you can cook up, you can show that there are some uniform bounds and the amplitudes. Here is one amplitude associated to a graph G, and you can show that they are bounded according to some degree of divergence here, which I write for the sake of example. So the key point here is that you get a decay in the number of external legs, as usual, if you want to have a renormalizability. And here, this parameter rho, this is the key thing, is zero for so-called Mellonic graph, which are a particular kind of spherical graph, and is smaller than minus one otherwise. So you can see from this, so this is the key thing that will tell you that the Mellonic graphs are the ones that contribute to the flow and only them. So since I'm in a kind of a floating cutoff picture, it's convenient to introduce dimensionless, so-called dimensionless coupling constants. So here, of course, there is no dimension a priori, but you can infer in the very same way as Astrid and Tim were doing, I think, you can infer what the dimension is from the degree of divergence. So essentially, you see that the contribution from the number of vertices of a given type, the number of bubbles of a given type, you need to cancel it through an appropriate rescaling, and this defines the kind of canonical dimensions of the couplings. So here's what you find: three minus half the number of external legs for a given bubble. And so I will write the flow equations in terms of these dimensionless coupling constants, because only in this case do you get Only in this case you get well-defined flows with the finite coefficients. I mean, other one coefficients. Okay. So here I don't want to say too much, but So you can write the flow equations in two steps. So first you can define an intermediate coupling constant, which takes into account a sum over Molyneux graphs, which once reduced to their local part, which means their tensor invariant part, are divergent. And the key thing to compute is this local part. So this is the tensor invariant part and divergent part of a given divergent part, which contributes to this flow. And then there is an important thing, even at the very low orders we will look at, which is the wave function renormalization, which is generically stronger than in usual quantum field theories. And something I would like to also emphasize, as compared to maybe the perturbative renormalization studies we did until now, is that because of this rescaling of the coupling constants, all Molyneux graphs contribute to the flow, and not only the Molyneux graphs which have the right number of vertices of the, I mean, there were many restrictions before, and here they are, it's more democratic in a sense. All Molyneux graphs contribute. Okay, so let me go fast on this. Now, to analyze what are the properties of the Gaussian fixed point, we can linearize, and essentially the canonical dimension will tell you who is relevant, who is not. So what you find is that the coupling constants with the strictly more than six external legs are irrelevant, correspond to irrelevant directions, so you can ignore them. And the only bubbles you need to implement in your model are these ones. So you have five of them a priori. And this one, Laurent, so this one is a singular bubble. So it represents a topological singularity, but you can see actually that it doesn't contribute to the flow because you cannot construct Molyneux graphs from this. And so it decouples, so you're free to set it to zero. It's consistent with the flow equations. So I will restrict only to these, which are spherical and also positive, by the way, interactions. I will also, just for the sake of simplicity, add a color permutation invariance. That is, if you permit the colors here, you leave the action invariance, so that you have only 1, 2, 3, 4 coupling constants. Okay, so this is the form of the linearized flow, and for example, you can compute the relevant directions in the U2 U4 plane, and this is what you get, which is very similar to scalar field theories. Okay, and now the key question is, what is the fate of the 5-6 couplings, which are the marginal ones? So to determine that, you need to go to second order, and for example, for the 6-1 couplings, you need to compute all these graphs and summing over all the colors here, but you can do it. And a key thing is that already at this order, you have wave function renormalization contour terms, because these graphs, in the sense of field theories, they are tadpoles, but still they have a a non-local part, a tensor invariant part at second order, which diverges. So you need to take them into account. And because of that, essentially, so you get equations like this, which relate the coupling constant at scale I minus one to the ones at scale I. And you see in red, these are the contributions coming from the wave function counter terms. And in blue, the negative contributions coming from the first sets of graphs before, or whatever. Okay. And the nice things is this time the reds win against the blues, and you can show that all these coefficients are positive, which means that the 5-6 couplings are marginally relevant. So actually, the model is asymptotically free. Okay, so this doesn't work anymore. So let me conclude now with the kind of speculative part of the talk. The nice aspect of these theories is that you can vary, you can consider like tensor algorithm theories with the same kind of gauge invariance conditions, but for various dimensions of the triangulation and dimensions of the group. So I note the first one small d and the big one, the other one big d. And essentially, you can see that the only just renormalizable model you can cook up are these. So this combination of the dimension of space-time, dimension of the group, and maximal valency of interactions. And a nice feature is that when we impose closure constraint like this, we are after 3D quantum gravity. And you see that the only combinations of space-time dimension and dimension of the symmetry group which match are the 3D case, like the small d equal 3, big d equal 3. So the SU2 model I just talked about. So this is a nice aspect. Another nice aspect is that it's only in dimension 3 that you have two possibilities for the group. So you have the dimension 3, with, for example, SU2, but you can also cook a models with dimension 4. So it's very similar in structure to the ordinary scalar field theories. Okay, because in space-time dimension 3, you can construct 5-6 models, and in space-time dimension 4, you can construct up to 5-4. And this is very similar here, except that it's the dimension of the group. So what I want to do in the future is to take advantage of this to explore the idea of the existence of a Wilson-Fischer fixed point. So the way one could analytically continue the group dimension, big D, would be to add a small compact U1 dimension here and continue the dimension of this U1, okay? And by analogy with the usual scalar field theory, I expect that there will be a Wilson-Fischer fixed point perturbatively in epsilon. And I would like to study its properties. And the key question, of course, is whether, because we don't really care about the dimension 4 groups, the key question is really that if this putative fixed point exists, does it survive when you send epsilon to 1? So I don't really know how to study this, but maybe one could try to resend the epsilon expansion. Or maybe a better direction would be to use the techniques that Astrid and team started to develop. I don't know. I'm not an expert, but I will try my best to learn. And why am I interested in this? There are two reasons, maybe. So the first one is that if there is a non-trivial fixed point, that might indicate that there is a natural flow towards a massive theory in the infrared. And this would mean that in the infrared, the Laplacian term that we introduced just for consistency is effectively suppressed, and that we get back to this kind of cutoff models, except that we have this would fix the rounding of the couplings and the value of the couplings. So this would be, I think, nice, because it would kind of complete the story of, we try to to construct the model, then we see that we have to add the Laplacian, but we don't know what it means, and then we kind of eliminate it at the end of the day. That would be nice, I think. And the second point would be to try to make contact with the non-perturbative results that Razvan presented. Maybe this non-Gaussian fixed point would switch on all the Mellonic couplings in a controlled way, and it would be the analog of the non-perturbative resummation of the one over n expansion. I don't know. So, okay, I will stop here. So this was my conclusion, but I think I told everything I wanted to say. So thank you for your attention.
What do
you
mean by not
linear fixed
point?
Is it
like the
theory
is free
subject?
What?
The theory is free in the UV now, statistically free? No, but I mean the second fixed point. The Wilson Fisher.
Okay.
More?
Does that mean the things that Joseph has about Bulatov being super normalizable?
So this one is about the colored model, no? So the one with simplicial interactions. And just one, the simplex. I mean, so it's necessarily more convergent because you have more constraints. Basically, you have.
Which one?
No, he's. You have. Sorry. It's not what?
Yeah, which one is more? And why is it more?
So the one, the colored simplicial model is more constrained because on each link, even the internal ones I was representing as black lines, they all have a projector. So the Bulatov projector. Well, here. No. They are kind of orthogonal in a sense. There are two. But
so that's why maybe relates to the,
these constraints are subsets.
Which constraints?
The constraints of this model are subset of the constraints, mm-hmm. because the other model would correspond to.
Can you describe the two models
So
what's in the background is that there seems to be different ways of defining 3D gravity.
Yeah. So what I tried to advocate here was discretization where you have kind of elementary building blocks which are triangulated boundaries, okay? And these triangulations are specific ones, the colored ones, okay? So if you do that, the dual faces you have on which you have constraints, like flatness constraints, are only, so if I put back the triangulation here, so you have basically some vertex here, and then you have the boundary here. Okay, difficult to, okay. And so this forms, let's say this forms a sphere. I don't know if you understand this drawing. So you have one point in the middle, then a sphere which is triangulated. And if I put back the one vertex in the middle and I join all the other vertices to this vertex in the middle, I get back the colored triangulation that Joseph is using. But the difference is that here, the only faces which have dynamical variables are these ones, the ones around the links which are on the boundary here. The links which are inside, they have no structure, no face. And so Joseph, the model you were talking about is exactly the same, except that you have also these constraints here. So you have constraints here and also here inside. So you have more, you impose more constraints in a sense. So it's only, I think, for...
Universality class. Yeah.
What?
You get different universality class. So there's two ways to define...
We don't have the continuum limit, so I don't know. But
It's different view we've explained.
Yeah. So, but it's only what's strange a bit is that it's only for, I don't know, combinatorial reasons that one is more convergent than the other one.
Okay, you know what it means?
No, I don't know. Maybe some you have more. I don't know. But I don't know if it's a good thing that the model is finite. I don't know. Right. I don't know. Then, if it's finite, it's difficult. It's also not only it's finite, but also it's kind of intractable. I mean, I would say, because it's very difficult to make any computations because you have too many intricacies between the different faces.
That's in the way I would clearly put it. The finiteness as a defect, because then you don't have the grinding machine of the universal. You don't know where it is.
But that's what I was asking, which is the notion of is one better because somehow there's a notion of continuity behind more than the other? That's what I was asking.
Yeah, maybe.
That's a flow.
Maybe I would.
That's
prefer.
A flow, but does it have, when I was mentioning, you know, I don't know.
But that's why I would prefer, I prefer this kind of perspective.
Well, I understand you can do more computation there, but,
yeah.
But physically, is there a... Okay.
I don't know.
More generic question on in some of these models, when one would like to introduce like Gauss modular constant, then one tries to work with quantum groups.
Yeah.
Do you have a view of these? You would expect to recover.
So you mean you would like to interpret?
You would like to generalize these or to recover a cosmological constant term within this setting, for instance, just to...
So I guess what you mean is that you could interpret the cutoff as a cosmological constant somehow, or...
For instance?
Yeah.
Or residual, residual,
sure. But then I think it's effect. Still... I think it's still useful because if the cosmological constant is a huge number, then you want to, just for computation reasons, computational reasons, you want to be able to lower this cutoff, because in the end, in my view, you're not interested in computing that scattering between huge triangles. So having to sum over huge spins is completely irrelevant. So you want to lower this cutoff, even if it's physical.
But could there be a way with your recommendation of continuum limit to test this idea that the cutoff could be seen as an effective constant term, like it is suggested by this quantum group,
or
it's too soon to say?
As far as I'm concerned, it's too soon. I don't know. Maybe.
Let's thank Sylvain again.